It's the one and two. 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 It's the one and two.
You really, so Peter, you really fucked us on this one, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, okay.
Well, okay.
I saw the title, you know, appealing. And I saw the length of the essay, 4 pages, and I was like, come on, that's great. Easy peasy.
I was reading For They Don't Know What They Do, which is pretty heavy stuff, and this is way harder than that.
I wonder what audience he was writing for, because this is for a French publication.
It's his PhD thesis, so.
It's the Sublime Hysteric.
Oh, I see, yeah.
It's bloody mental.
It's fine mental. In it.
It's bloody monumental.
Translated by our friend Rex Butler.
I saw that. Our friend who we've never met.
I feel like I know him because he's Australian.
How's it going in Australia these days?
It's actually raining.
Is the season turning?
I feel like it's turning, yeah. Yeah. It shouldn't be raining, but it is. And Piggy's by the window watching the rain.
Oh, that's cute. Piggy is the name of Michael's girlfriend. I'm in a farm right now, and I don't even know where I am. It's off of a road, on the side of a hill, and you can see like other towns in the distance on other hills. And I've got chickens and horses and goats. What else? There's a bunny, some cats. Dogs. Nice. And it's this German family of my wife's friends. My wife's family. Friends of my wife's family. And the father is used to be a university professor, and he wrote a book on Lacan and film studies.
Oh wow. Have you talked to him about that?
I talked to him about it a few years ago. He told me then that he kind of forgot most of it because he wrote it like 30 years ago.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. The amount of shit you forget is unbelievable.
I don't even remember the essay that we just read.
Yeah. But, you know, as Nietzsche said, in order to live, you must forget.
Yeah. Like the other cows in the neighborhood around here, I also forget.
Hopefully you don't see a horse and go crazy.
That was Nietzsche's like symbol of forgetting was the cow. Oh, I get that. That was funny. and then he compares women to animals at some point. And I remember being at a party and there was a girl who went to my school and we were talking about Nietzsche and feminism. And she was like, well, he called women animals. And I was like, that's true. That's not a very good look for him. But if you want to be very, very generous, Nietzsche really liked cows.
Do you feel as if you're in philosophy country?
Yeah, there's one of their sons is studying at a university nearby, and he's writing a undergrad thesis on Habermas and like German government arts allocation funding. Which seems to be the, you know, about as exciting as Habermas gets.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it sounds fucking riveting.
Yeah, it sounds so boring.
It was fun, actually. We were having a meal yesterday, and this German family was giving me the lowdown on all the other kinds of Germans, down to, like, very specific cities and towns, and, like, why exactly they suck. and how, you know, these people are weird and those people are strange, and you know, in Bavaria they drink beers from liter steins, and in Cologne they drink beer from a little glass. And I said to them, like, you know, coming from North America, Germans are just one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Nazis.
I was wearing a Heidelberg shirt the other day, and it's got like a few happy little Germans, some Volk dancing around on it. And I have to keep in mind that not everyone necessarily likes joking about Nazis, because someone referenced my shirt. I was like, and I called it my Nazi shirt, and it did not land.
Didn't land.
Apparently, the people in Heidelberg are very stuck up and rich, stuffy. That's where Albert Speer is from.
Who's Albert Speer?
Albert Speer was Hitler's architect and a lot of other things. He eventually became like one of Hitler's main dudes. Hegel taught at Heidelberg. Heidelberg is only probably 30-minute drive from here. It's a very beautiful city.
It is nice.
And apparently the Americans didn't bomb it because of that, because they were like, oh, that's a nice place. Let's not bomb it, and we can stay there. Frankfurt is an interesting case, too, because it's like, actually, it's cool. If you go up on the hill over here, you can see Frankfurt way in the distance, like very kind of like nestled very far away against the mountains. And Frankfurt's interesting because it was like totally bombed, obviously, flattened. And it's like the only place in Europe that has skyscrapers, like a lot of skyscrapers. And it's also, you know, the banking center of Germany in Europe. And as far as German cities go, like pretty kind of open and leftish. And then, of course, you know, the Frankfurt School. Drew by the Frankfurt School.
What's
once.
The...
It was like that meme, like the pointing meme. It's like, oh my God. It's just a really boring building. And I was like, oh my God.
That's where they invented postmodern neo-Marxism.
Exactly. I forget where I learned this, maybe Jordan Peterson, that's where they decided to hollow out the values of Western society.
Yeah.
and then imbue communist ideas at the level of culture, because they couldn't change the economy. That's what that was all about.
Definitely. So how are we doing, fellas? Welcome to Zizek and so on. I am your co-host, Peter X.
I'm the other co-host, Michael.
I'm Will.
Will, just while I remember, this is a public episode. We also have some Patreon content. Every other episode, it's all on patreon.com, $5 a month. We have Discord. We're putting up some Zizek lectures. We have a reading group. Come join us.
The Zizek lecture thing. What I've been doing is I've been ripping the audio off of YouTube videos so that people can listen to it at their convenience in audio form. Do you guys hear that horse just now?
No. You're going crazy.
Yeah, you lost it,
man. That would actually be a terrifying voice to just hear in your head.
There was a hole in the market there for a little bit that quickly got filled, interestingly, right after I started putting the audio back on.
Do we want to keep this subtle shout-out, or...
Subtle shout-out to the collected recordings?
Yeah.
Who the hell knows who that guy is?
Yeah, we don't know, but respect, because I'm sure it's helped guide many, many people into Zizek. It helped me.
No. Yeah, massive. I think I listened to every post on there at a certain point in time.
Thanks, mystery man. Oh.
So, Peter, what's this essay about, mate?
Well, Michael, it's simply... what the connection between, or what the influence of Hegel is with Lacan. It's called Lacan, At What Point Is He Hegelian? Meant for publication in a French journal in 99, translated by Rex Butler, as you said.
Because this is an excerpt from the most sublime hysteric Zizek's PhD thesis, which was published in French, obviously, before, right? Did he write it in French? Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
That would make sense. Yeah. From his later writing.
Slavoj Žižek,
more academic.
Hegelian, Lacanian, polyglot.
You know, there's a Zizek nightclub in Buenos Aires.
No,
and I think there's even I was looking at this right before we started talking. I think there's even a subgenre of dance music called Zizek.
Zizek dance music.
It's called Zizek Club.
Close out the episode with some Zizek dance music.
I also like that Zizek like to vibe and like lo-fi Zizek to vibe and study to. Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Here, wait, let me read the description here. Zizek, Buenos Aires' most vital club and record label, imports its searing mix of hip-hop, reggaeton, dancehall, and yes, cumbia to the after-party for the Latin Alternative Music Conference, et cetera, et cetera. Zizek co-founder, LG, comes straight off his Central Park show with blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so it's a club. I guess they like Zizek.
Midnight Saturday in Buenos Aires, and the Zizek Collective are warming up for tonight's show. The Zizek musicians and DJs are producing some of the most progressive sounds in Latin America today. Leaders of the global dance craze known as Cumbia Digital, a modern take on the percussive African rhythm developed in Colombia two centuries ago.
We've basically brought it out into the 21st century, mixing it with electronic music and computers and software.
American Grant Duhl co-founded the Zizek Collective with two Argentine partners. He says their musical offerings have helped defy social stereotypes.
I think Zizek is the voice of Argentina.
It's hard to picture Zizek's vibe as reggaeton.
Yeah,
I'll say that.
All right.
Okay, so we referenced the beginning of the essay. Okay, he does start, like, it does follow a cohesive structure, at least,
mm-hmm.
while being very complicated. Or he starts off with a brief reference to Foucault in Foucault's description of, like, philosophy being kind of quintessentially anti-Platonic. All philosophers, beginning with Aristotle, had defined their projects against or distancing themselves to Plato. Zizek also makes the point, I believe, in the beginning of Less Than Nothing. He spends some time following that.
Yeah. I mean, he's developed it in other places by saying, like, Plato, Descartes, and Hegel are the three who people are kind of forced,
mm-hmm.
because of the event of their thinking, forced to contend with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which he mentions here in a slightly different way. He says, in the same way, one could say that what defines philosophy in the last two centuries is its dissociation from Hegel, the incarnate monster of panlogism, the total dialectical mediation of reality, the complete dissolution of reality into the self-movement of the idea. And that's certainly the predominant academic understanding of Hegel. Maybe it's diminishing now, but certainly, like, when I learned about Hegel in university, that's what people...
We've probably said this on the pod before, but when we were in school, like, if I wanted to get cheap points in an essay, I would say, like, this has nothing to do with Hegelian totality or something like that. Like,
mm-hmm.
and then everyone, you know, the teacher might put a mark next to it and be like, ah, oh, very good. And I don't know where I picked that up, but it was like Hegel was a bad word.
Yeah.
And everyone that we were studying, you know, Hegel is a punching bag. Deleuze and Foucault and all those Frenchies. But it's Hegel of the stereotype, of the unrelenting machine of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
The crazy megalomania of absolute reason.
Absolute knowledge.
Absolute knowledge, sorry.
Idiot. You're an idiot that you don't remember every bit of this very complicated essay.
Mm-hmm.
And Zizek goes on, he says, one knows well that Hegel affirms the fundamentally antagonistic character of actions, the decentering of the subject, but all the same, this division is eventually overcome in the self-mediation of the absolute idea that ends up suturing all wounds. Not so, according to our last podcast. If you want to hear it, it's called The Wound. Wait, what is it called again? The Wound of Spirit. The wound is kind of important for Zizek. But in this kind of prevalent view of Hegel, everything is kind of tied up nicely in the synthesis, the suturing of all wounds. So in other words, like any attempt to define oneself, one system within Hegel's sphere of influence requires a point of block identification. The thing, he calls it the thing for these sorts of philosophers. There's some monstrous, horrible thinginess to Hegel's system.
Which he's referencing Lacan there, I think.
Mm-hmm. So he says that there's a limiting of Hegel obviously going on here, even for Lacan's idea of Hegel. This essay is about how Lacan used and was influenced by Hegel. But in Lacan's own writing, there isn't a whole lot, and it's usually a negative mention. But there is a way, in Lacan's own words, that he's influenced by Hegel, which is the kind of master-slave dialectic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Michael mentioned this to me a couple weeks ago, and since I haven't been able to unsee it or hear it, that there's a whole lot of referencing of Zizek that goes on without attributing the idea to him.
Big time. Big time.
So Zizek says here that when Lacan is specifically referencing Hegel, he totally miscomprehends Hegel. And it's at the points where he thinks he's not being Hegelian,
mm-hmm.
where he's being the most Hegelian.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Michael, I was reading a little bit of Looking Awry yesterday to try to like find an essay to read for this week. And again, there, Zizek is saying that there's no such thing as post-structuralism. It's just an idea that came from American academia that was just fixed onto a number of disparate thinkers in the French world.
Mm-hmm. Also, crucial to the rise of, what do they call it, like the Derridaization of American literary departments was, right. like, again, a misreading of Derrida, or like a context-free reading of Derrida, where it just basically became a fucking stylistic choice maneuver.
Yeah. And another example, Flissfetter brought this to my attention, that noir is just a fabrication of the American university system as well, like film noir.
Oh, yeah?
Mm, yeah. I thought it was, but that term, wasn't it invented by the, oh, I got a rainbow here, boys.
Oh, shit.
Wasn't that a term?
Thousand-year rainbow.
I forget what I was saying.
Okay, you said the rainbow thing. It was Foucault, Derrida. Film noir.
Noir. Didn't the term film noir come from a French film book?
Wasn't it also
that's
like...
That's why it's in a French, you know, film noir.
Maybe.
Noir. Or maybe the film noir becomes film noir when like neo-noir comes out. Like the reference creates the thing. I don't know.
That's a nice...
Because, you know, they're really big on neo-noirs in like the 80s and 90s.
I think this book came out in the 50s.
What's your favorite neo-noir?
What's that one with Gene Hackman?
Oh, yeah.
From what era? In the 70s?
The 70s, yeah.
Chinatown is fucking great.
Oh, yeah. It's a fucking
long era. Goodbye.
Yeah, The Long Goodbye. That's cool.
What's the one with the guy who plays Ross and Monica's father?
Night Moves is what I was thinking of.
Oh, man, that one's great, yeah. Reservoir Dogs, neo-noir.
Matrix? Is that a new noir?
I could see that. Okay, so were we going somewhere with that digression?
No. Nah.
We're just trying to talk about something other than the essay. I think that's what's happening.
That's what's happening.
Okay, but I think what we can do basically is we can say there is a Hegel for Lacan. There's Lacan's version of Hegel, other than there's where Hegel is influencing Lacan and he doesn't necessarily know it or he isn't aware of it.
But then it's not just that Lacan is influenced by Hegel, but it's that, like, according to Zizek, his core insights are of the same kind as Hegel's core insights. Like,
yes.
They're homologous. They're, like, on the same plane.
Enjoy the music for a minute.
So Zizek asks, what is implied then by this relationship between Hegel and Lacan? Today, things seem clear. Although no one denies that Lacan owed a certain debt to Hegel, it is argued that all Hegelian references are limited to specific theoretical borrowings and restricted to a well-defined period in Lacan's work. Between the late 40s and early 50s, Lacan tried to articulate the psychoanalytic process in terms of an intersubjective logic of the recognition of desire and or the desire for recognition. And you can see how the master-slave dialectic would match and kind of inform that. where both master and the slave seek recognition from the other to define themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But Zizek, no, it's like already Lacan was trying to keep his distance from the closure of the Hegelian system from absolute knowledge. And then he mentions like, there seems to be a fundamental There seems to be a fundamental incompatibility. I don't want to say that word for me. Fundamental incompatibility.
A fundamental incompatibility
between Hegelian absolute knowledge, what in the kind of Kojiev academic idea of absolute knowledge as closed circle, and the Lacanian barred other. Is Lacan not the anti-Hegel par excellence?
Yeah, he says, I like this because he says that Lacan is fundamentally Hegelian, but without knowing it. And he says right before that, it's time to approach this debate in a different light by expressing the relationship between Hegel and Lacan in an original way. And then bam, the next 35 years happened.
Yeah. It is an original way.
Zizek was like, hold my beer. And then he wrote 70 books.
Yeah.
So I wrote this little bit. Just as the Lacanian subject confronts the traumatic void in the other, in the final stage of psychoanalytic treatment, Hegel's concept of absolute knowledge represents a final reconciliation with the lack that is inherent in the symbolic order. So you've got thinkers that are grappling with the same kind of problem, the way in which the process of signification and meaning-making is haunted by a constitutive lack or void.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. Well, you just kind of ruined the end of the neo-noir, Michael, but that is true.
I also actually pre-prepared a statement on that topic, Michael.
Go for it.
Because I've been reading For the Know Not What They Do 5 months too late. But it was convenient because this morning I was reading a passage where he was explaining this interaction between the thinking of Hegel and Lacan. And he shows... Zizek shows how at the beginning of the logic, Hegel argues that being and nothing are the same.
Mm-hmm.
They're differentiated by a shift in perspective where being becomes nothing and nothing becomes being conceptually. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going back a few years here from when I read it, but as far as my memory goes, this passage that Hegel argues that if we're to attempt to describe nothing, we're forced to positivize it by saying nothing is something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're forced to use the same language to describe nothing as being. Being is. I thought this was nice that in the tradition of philosophy regarding being, there's being is becoming, and then with Hegel, it's being is nothing.
Mm.
I mean, that's obviously not the only thing he has to say about it, but anyway, there's like, Zizek's going into this, so there's a separation between the two, which rests on a parallax.
Separation between Hegel and Lacan, or...
Being
and nothing.
Being and nothing. So that in as much as nothing and being are distinct, it's based purely on a shift in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that like this occurs on the epistemological level in terms of how we know, right? But it's also a claim about the thing in itself, the thing mm-hmm. itself. And the dialectical process moves because the core of the self-identity of a thing is also its opposite. Like you were just saying, Michael, there's a split in the thing itself or a
mm-hmm.
lack.
Mm-hmm.
And the gap opened here between like one and the other or one and another or one and the two or being and nothing is where Zizek says the real emerges. So the real is the almost nothing, which sustains the gap that separates a thing from itself. The real is a stain, a certain imperceptible, unfathomable, ultimately illusory feature mm-hmm. that accounts for the absolute difference within identity. So that's nice. Cool. Like the kind of where Lacan touches Hegel's thinking is at that level.
Yeah. And you think of the barred other as a matter of an individual facing another, someone and another. But it's cool to think about it conceptually as otherness, as negativity in the Hegelian system.
I guess that would be the big other in Lacan's thinking. No.
Okay. So back to what you were saying with. How Zizek is drawing a comparison between the Hegelian system and Lacan's system. He says that the best way to approach the relationship is through the logic of the signifier and how that speaks to the Hegelian dialectic in three stages, the three successive stages of the progressive of the symbolic in Lacan.
This is very heavy stuff. and or we're going to do our best here, but we're as confused as you are.
Yeah.
So basically, in the 40s and the 50s, Lacan attempts to articulate the intersubjective logic of recognition and desire, careful to distance himself from the closure of absolute knowledge of the Hegelian system. Then later, there's the introduction of the logic of the not all and the concept of the barred other, which makes his initial reference to Hegel obsolete. And then there's Lacan's concept of the barred other is completely opposed to Hegel's absolute knowledge as a closed and complete system. So Lacan's barred other is an empty knowledge or a void that signifies the limits of knowledge. So Zizek's kind of offering what he calls the Hegel of the logic of the signifier, a self-referential process centered on a void.
That's pretty good.
Very well put.
We'd have to find a way to tie that into something.
Well, no, I think that's a good place to place that. That like is the overall arc of his argument in this section. Simply, I guess, as simply as we can make it, the three stages are: first stage is out of the function of the field of speech and language in psychoanalysis.
So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is kind of like mirror stage era Lacan, is it not?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's this, Zizek says, it places the accent on intersubjective dimension of speech, and it brings out the historical and symbolic dimensions to, like, let's say an analysand's treatment, locates them in terms of symptoms connected with traumas, and
places that in a symbolic meaning.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then he says, interestingly, basically, this is a phenomenological conception of language close to Merleau-Ponty. Where the goal of analysis is to produce the recognition of desire through speech, through full speech, to integrate that desire within the universe of signification.
So it's all about integrating, he doesn't say this, but like integrating the ego and smoothing over the subject's own phenomenological experience of signification.
Right. So in the second stage, which he says is exemplified in the purloined letter.
So shout out to
episode on that. Share back catalog. I believe that was one of your first episodes, Michael. Maybe your second, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, podcast always arrives at its destination.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the title. Not a bad little title on that.
Not bad, but fairly convoluted, maybe.
You think we should have just called it the purloined letter? You know what?
Yep.
We should have called it that.
We just should have called it the purloined letter.
How about we go back and just call it that? We might get some more plays.
And we'll call the spy who shagged me yours.
The shark
Jaws.
Who shagged me.
Sure.
Yeah. All you fuckers out there didn't like the shark who shagged me. It probably should just be called Jaws. Like Zizek and Jaws or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so he says it follows purloined letter. It places the emphasis on the signifying order, places the emphasis of the logic of the signifier on the symbolic order.
Yeah. So like I guess this is the structuralist Lacan, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So like stressing the differential synchronous structure of the signifying chain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The logic of the not all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? Can you expand on that, Michael?
So in that signifying chain, if each word has its meaning only in relation to another word, in its difference,
it's or in structuralist speak, synchronous.
Mm-hmm.
This is the synchronous nature of it.
You never arrive at a fully constituted field. There's not a complete totality.
Cool. Your letter is purloined.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Thanks for clarifying the concept.
I love this though. Purloined.
It was funny when we were doing that episode, we were like, purloined, like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
We were like trying to.
And it means exactly what it should mean.
It means stolen.
Yeah.
And we're like, it's kind of like when.
Yeah, like pilfered or something, you know, like just one of those words that falls out of usage.
Yeah.
Oh, someone was describing the flavor of a wine to me yesterday, and they said desiccated coconut or some shit like that. Like all you have to do is just say coconut, and even then
it tastes like a bounty bar. I'm just
gonna like
get a beer.
Using like a fancy word pertaining to the coconut is just fucking stupid.
Did we lose Michael?
He's a big fan of decimated coconut.
He's like, that, I'm fucking out. So yeah, this is the stage where it's not about the the phenomenological being of the subject. It's about the way in which a subject is taken up in the signifying chain.
Mm-hmm.
And for this reason, I think Zizek wants to say that there's a way in which the subject is alienated, I think in a bad way, without remainder, desubjectivized. And I think, like, as far as that the structuralist notion of the subject goes, it's very much that there isn't anything that really constitutes the subject. The subject exists or is reduced to a place or sign within the symbolic structure.
Yeah.
He does go into this thing called the schema L, which is a Lacanian, what do they call that? I guess a schema, a diagram, a graph. It's like two inverted triangles touching at the points. And it shows the relation between the ego and the small other and the split subject and the big other. And it's a very complicated interaction, and we're not going to get into it.
So it's like the Louvre, like the two triangles in the Louvre.
Exactly. Dan Brown.
Robert Langdon would have, yeah.
But yeah, this, like, I mean, even we used the term last week's episode, the Levi-Straussian notion of this bundle of relations.
Yeah.
And I do remember in a Levi-Strauss book I picked up one time, he said that something like that he never felt like he was a substantive subject, but that he was always, but that he was rather a kind of intersection of relations. So Levi-Strauss invented intersectionality as well.
So I think that's the second stage. We got the phenomenological and then the structuralist.
Or is the first one, could you even say it's the imaginary stage?
Well,
imaginary,
he says,
then symbolic.
But Zizek says the first stage was phenomenological. This one rather is more structuralist. The problem with the second stage is that the subject, insofar as it is subject of the signifier, is radically unthinkable. And that's what you were saying. The third stage is certainly not some kind of synthesis. That would make it, you know, the wrong kind of Hegelian. The third stage must break with this common edifice, because the first two stages are, you know, can be compatible in some way.
In what sense? You don't have to answer that question, but
he says two versions of the same theoretical edifice. One might say structuralist psychoanalysis. I don't know. He doesn't really get into it, how they're complementary.
I guess because the first stage is on the level of the signifier, but it's kind of about the subject's coherent, if traumatic, place within that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second, while it's kind of, or like synchronized, let's say, in the signifying structure, there's still, I mean, even that schemata L thing, like we're still dealing with the level of the ego there. And then in the third stage, we're getting into this notion of like, the barred other, of the lack in the other, right?
And he says, the
objet petit.
Yeah. So he says the third stage must break with this common edifice, this complementary relationship of a speech filled with signification and a self-sufficient structure by positing a barred other, incomplete, not all, an other articulated against the void, an other which carries within it an extimate, non-symbolizable kernel.
The lack in the other means that there's a remainder, a non-integratable residuum in the other, or objet a. And the subject is able to avoid total alienation only insofar as it posits itself as the correlative of this remainder.
Because if it was purely structuralist, there would not be a remainder. If it was like purely like subsumed into the system, there would not be that excess.
Because we're dealing here with like the subject as the other to the other's desire, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it means that the subject has to recognize that there's something lacking or incomplete in the symbolic order, and that this lack is what drives their desire. And by acknowledging it, they position themselves in relation to it. And that's where the subject can maintain a sense of agency and autonomy in the symbolic order, rather than being spoken it.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also in the sense, he says, like what I was trying to say before, like this is a distinct conception of the subject from a notion of the ego on the level of like misrecognition in the first stage. And it's not the subject that's lost purely in the machinic process of the structural combination.
Mm-hmm. Outside of the imaginary misrecognition.
I think you could say that this is like the level of dialectics here.
Stage. Absolutely, absolutely. And just the brief way that he describes the barred other means an other that is not simply an anonymous machine, but rather a desiring other, an other that lacks the object cause of desire, another that wants something from the subject. Chevoix.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are the three stages of the relationship between the Hegelian dialectic and logic of the signifier. There's the master-slave reference, I guess, in the first. And then one might say that the second is maybe a reference to the pure, like, monstrous Hegelian system, something that doesn't have space for something that is like an all-encompassing system, right? You could view structuralism in that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe in the more proper Zizekian understanding of the Hegelian dialectic, we can see that in the kind of advent of the barred other in Lacan.
This was interesting. You said that with the barred other, because there's a void in the signifier that accompanies the movement of symbolization, or rather, he says, on another level, because there's a nonsense which necessarily emerges as soon as there is the advent of sense.
Of sense, yeah.
Which I think is what Deleuze, I think that's the Deleuzian point he's making there from that book. What's that book called?
Logic of Sense.
Logic of Sense. But I think if you put it in Hegelian terms, there's a contradiction which emerges as soon as there is a form of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Like, how could consciousness emerge in a absolute system?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so...
Because a form of consciousness emerges out of a contradiction of a... What's the word to use? I felt like I said situation too much in the last episode.
I said manifestation too much? Fucking hell.
I listened to it again after you thought you said manifestation too often. I think you only said it like 5 times. That's not too bad.
That's a lot in an hour.
And in fact, at one point you said manifestation and I was like, yeah, manifestation.
I won't want to fucking define manifestation by saying manifestation.
Hermeneutical circle, baby.
Well, that's what... Oh, man. I love that part of for They Know Not What They Do, where he has like a diagram of the Hegelian dialectic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I think a lot of people would think of it as, let's just say, like a circle that clearly designates the terrain and defines it as like an absolute dimension of knowledge. And then there's the, okay, wait. With Kant, picture like it's a broken circle. So we can, Zizek says, we can risk a topological specification of the Kant-Hegel relationship by stating it like this. The structure of the Kantian transcendental field is that of a circle with a gap, since man, as a finite being, does not have access to the totality of beings. The gap is the noumenal, right? The thing in itself. However, contrary to the common view, the passage from Kant to Hegel does not consist in closing the circle. If this were the case, Hegel would simply return to pre-Kantian, pre-critical metaphysics. Hegel does indeed close the circle, but this very closure introduces a supplementary loop, transforming it into the inner eight of the Möbius band. Hmm. Picture an eyeball with an iris looking to the side.
And that looks like an epicycle when they were mapping out the movements of stars or of planets in the solar system. The only way they could properly account for the movements within the Aristotelian system of absolute spheres, like perfect rotations, was to include a little circle inside of it.
That's a nice point, Pete. Cool.
Thank you. So, Hegel, maybe in
manifestation?
The same sense.
See, Aristotle manifests planets.
So Zizek says, after he shows that little diagram, he says, in other words, Hegel definitely maintains the gap around which the transcendental field is structured. The very retroactivity of the dialectical process, the positing of presuppositions, attests to it. The point is just that he displaces it. The external limit preventing the closure of the circle changes into the curvature, which makes the very closed circle vicious.
The closed circle vicious?
Like a vicious circle. Vicious.
Oh,
vicious,
I see.
That is, yeah, he was talking about vicious earlier, but...
Vicious. Got you with every owl.
Dude, fucking great song.
You with that. You don't talk about Lou Reed. Lou Reed's fucking cool. He's got a lot of bad albums, cool. But he's very cool.
The problem is that he has like 2 good solo albums that I'm aware of, but maybe there are others.
There's a fair few good ones.
There's the one he did.
He does have an absolute shitload of terrible music, though. I must say.
He did. He did that one with Metallica somehow.
Lulu. Yeah. My friend really likes Lulu. Like, he really wants to like elevate it to one of the greatest albums of the century. He's like, no, it's like it's Metallica's the Greek chorus in the song.
Oh my god!
You ever see him performing with Pavarotti?
Nah.
Perfect Day. Oh my god, it's so funny. Just like Lou Reed, just looking like destroyed by drugs and life. I'm like really embodying the like the feel of Perfect Day. And then the chorus, Pavarotti comes in. He's like, this is totally inappropriate.
Why did I just talk about that?
I don't know. Because you're making some obscure point about Lou Reed.
I'm trying to remember. Yeah, why did you bring up Four They Don't Know What They Do?
Because I'm reading it right now. Is the answer to that? Yeah, I don't know why I brought that.
What was
up.
The last thing you read, Pete? Because that's what would have excited him.
Well, just the where Zizek kind of ties up that three-part reference to Lacan's Hegel is not actually stepping into Lacan being influenced by Hegel, because he ends that part by saying the conceptual field of Lacan's third stage, that of the Bart other, would thus be a field of the other that resists on all sides the achievement of realization, an other emptied out by a hypothetical kernel of real impossible, whose inertia blocks the dialectization, the sublation in and through the symbol. In short, an anti-Hegelian other par excellence, it would seem.
I'll have to take his word for that.
Yeah. Because of the death drive. Oh no. Now we're going into beginning of page three. Das Ingenden Heisen Menschen.
The undoing or something. Undercurrent over there. Okay. Yeah, because the end of the second one goes into a wacky bit that I didn't understand.
We're already down to the Freudian concept, which designates this act of annihilation.
Because the death drive is like structurally that which escapes symbolization, right?
What were that the last thing you just read, Peter? It sounds like his thing in Sublime Object, where he identifies the real as the like impenetrable kernel, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he immediately gets away from that in For They Know Not What They Do.
Yeah, that statement doesn't really ring true.
After his first book, it doesn't ring true.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's the same with Lacan. Like after Seminar 7, he immediately moves away from that notion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the real, let me just see if I can find this. This is a feature of Zizek's thinking. Is you know, according to Todd McGowan, Zizek was like the first Lacanian thinker to really give prominence to the level to the register of the real, right? Because up till then, especially in the realm of Lacanian studies as it was applied to film studies, was much more engaged with the register of the imaginary. I think you can also make the case that the Lacan of Zizek is the Lacan of the symbolic, but what the fuck do I know? But he does say in his second book, which is For the Know Not What They Do, that one of his major criticisms of the Sublime Object of ideology, and this sounds like the thing that he was just saying, is what we just said, that the impossible real kernel is that's like the unsymbolizable real, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then he moves immediately to this notion of the stain, right? That the real itself is nothing but what he calls a grimace of reality, something which is nothing but a distorted perspective on reality, something which only shines through such a distortion since it is in itself completely without substance. Real is a stain in which we perceive face to face, like the devil's face appearing amid tornado clouds in the News of the World cover photo. The obstacle which forever distorts our perception of reality, producing anamorphic stains in it.
Interesting. Yeah, and I think another way, like, okay, so there's a different way that he approaches those questions, like as he moves through his work. What he focuses on here after that initial three-part description of the structuralist Hegelian Lacan, he uses the same three-part argument for the death drive in Lacan, and just simply, like as simple as I can make it, following the same three, there's the first phenomenological stage of the death drive, where
it stands for the annihilation of the thing in its immediate corporeal reality.
Yeah. There's a kind of immediacy towards it in the same way of the phenomenological description in the first example. The second, he says, is the structural stage of the death drive, where the symbolic order, insofar as it follows its own laws beyond the imaginary, a mechanism which, by means of its automatism, breaks, disturbs the subject's equilibrium. the death instinct, this is Zizek quoting Lacan here, the death instinct is only a mask of the symbolic order. The third stage, in which Lacan places the accent, and this is just what you were saying, on the real as a kind of impossible kernel, death drive is a name for that kind of impossibility within the system on which it depends. And then he kind of ties it all together in a, I thought, a pretty beautiful way of making this Hegelian, where he, that unintegratable thing, which is also a Freudian concept, Freud calls it an action which is canceled out by a second action. So it's as if neither action took place.
Negation.
Yeah, exactly. So, or more simply, retroactive cancellation. And it's more than a coincidence that one finds the same term in Hegel in the supreme power of spirit, the same term that Freud uses for that.
Das ungeschehen machen.
So this power, this like unmasking of a previous action, the cancellation of it, is conceivable only on a symbolic level. So you can conceive of this concept as the high, Michael, just as you were saying, like the highest manifestation of negativity, as the Hegelian version of the death drive. It's not an accidental or marginal element in the Hegelian edifice, but rather designates the crucial moment of the dialectical process, the so-called negation of negation. I think that's where he kind of ties all these things together, like not only between Hegel and Lacan, but also with the death drive and the barred other and Hegelian negation of negation, which pretty fucking cool.
And this is he quotes Hegel in the encyclopedia saying, "The accomplishing of the infinite purpose consists therefore in sublating the illusion that has not yet been accomplished." That retroactive dimension there, you can see it.
You can't know. So he says like, yeah, so his last paragraph, I actually thought was like kind of beautiful here. He says, "You can't accomplish an end by attaining it. There can never be like a conclusion. There's always, while advancing, the feeling that you're not yet at your aim or at your end. And then all of a sudden, it's like too late. It's already passed. So there's always a too soon that changes into too late without detecting the exact moment of its transformation." And this is true of what Hegel says about philosophy, right? The whole affair has a structure of a missed encounter. Along the way, the truth, which we have not yet attained, pushes us forward like a phantom, promising that it awaits us at the end of the road. But all of a sudden, we perceive that we were always already in the truth.
Nice.
Really nice. So, yeah. I guess that's where Zizek finds Hegel and Lacan.
Sweet. Did we do it?
I think we did it.
Sick.
I think we, I think that's it.
I'm gonna Michael here and bring in one more idea, but
okay.
But cut this out.
Go ahead.
Rude.
See, Michael, that's how it feels.
Pulling a Michael here.
you, that feeling in your stomach right now, that's how it feels.
Yeah, it looks like we did it, and we saved you the trouble of reading this, maybe. Or maybe read it and try to clarify it. I read it twice, and it only got more mysterious the second time I read it.
And we should promote that we're talking to Robert Fowler next.
Oh, cool. Inner passivity and everything.
Delegated enjoyment and such. Illusions without owners.
Speaking of one person who says something and then someone else who says something, negating the process and maybe saying it, the origin of who said it gets mixed up and maybe cancels it out. Did Robert Fowler or Zizek come up with the term interpassivity?
Because I think it was Robert Fowler.
Okay, because I remember in Fowler's book, he attributes it to Zizek, doesn't he?
He uses Zizek's example of the hand laughter as an example of interpassivity.
Yeah, but then I'm sorry to bring this book up again, but in fucking For the Know Not What They Do, he cites Robert Fowler's example of canned laughter and thanks him for the example.
So Zizek thanks Fowler for canned laughter?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I've got it mixed up then. So what? Okay, in 1991, he referenced Robert Fowler, you reckon? That doesn't seem right to me.
It's in the preface, so 2001 or 2 or whatever. Like Michael, it's from the preface of the second edition. He says that,
right? So like 2001 or whatever.
Oh,
it was.
The preface. Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. Anything else, fellas?
That's it.
No, I think that's it.
Cool. From Zizek and so on. See you next week. If you're a patron, only if you're a patron. See you in 2 weeks. Otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you.